All right, everybody, let's get settled down for the discussion session. So this is, you know, just to give everyone who had a poster or has a highlight, something interesting in the works, a chance to say what they're working on. This is kind of going to be like a results blitzkrieg. So we're going to have a lot of very exciting, very, very short talks. So all this is the order on the board. So we're going to start off with Joss, and we're going to go down the board and then over to the other side. So if you're kind of coming up to speak, get up here, or else your 2 minutes will be gone. And I will try to be as rigorous as possible with my you know, timing. And your slide is over here, so I'll advance it for you. Okay. Joss,
thank you. All right, so we have 2 minutes plus one to discuss. I was part of a team that gave rise to the concept of WIFMOS. And in fact, some of the others are here, like Rosie and James and Catherine. You were on that team. Very good. And that project hopefully will still go ahead, but it's sort of receding onto the over the horizon for now. And this gave Ken Freeman and myself a cause for concern, enough that we pushed through the following instrument concept, which is now fully funded and is going ahead. It's 2011 start date to 2015, possibly 2016. And the key point here is that we're targeting 1.5 million stars brighter than a V of 14. So these will all have better than 1% Gaia distance errors. So very accurate positions, which means for main sequence turnoff and subgiants, 1/5 of the survey, you'll have accurate ages, which is very, very exciting for a whole host of reasons. So we'll scan half the southern sky. We're going to target the old thin and the thick disk up to 45 degrees, 15 to 45 degrees, and across the bulge, of course. And we're going to have four bands, each with about 300 angstroms, resolving power of 30,000. So you're up at shell resolutions. But the really important point is here. These four bands give us the light elements, some light elements, an interesting spread of alpha, of course, as Judy was saying, sort of hydrostatic and the explosive alphas, iron peak elements, light S process, barium, lanthanum, heavy S process, and unfortunately only one R process for now. But you can imagine now decomposing the galaxy into its multiple components and looking at the evolution of these different element groups as a function of cosmic time. So, sorry? Five seconds or 5 minutes? Okay, 5 seconds. All right, so I've finished already.
All right, one question. Shout it out.
Hundreds guaranteed for almost all these lines. We've synthesized these with in a PhD project. Thank you. That was my point to Ken. Ken didn't believe me, so that was rubbish.
All right.
So that's exactly what I said to him. Yeah, I know where you're going with that, and Ken had the same idea. Yes, you
All
can
right.
go.
Sorry.
You can go a couple of magnitudes and do an awful lot on over a wider field, but that's the original target anyway. Sorry.
My name is Andrei Kravtsov. So I want to talk about this paper and the result that was discussed about today. This is a paper in Nature that appeared just last month. So my motivation for the study was that I saw that the title should have included the question. And so I was interested to see, you know, whether it's a question or not. So anyway, so this is the result. It's 10 to the 7, you know, despite the large... despite the large range of luminosities, the masses are very similar. I want to understand whether we can... whether it comes out of CDM simulations, naturally you can guess the answer, it does. I looked at four Milky Way sized CDM halos. I measured the ratios when they accreted. I measured the masses at which they had at the time. I measured the masses within 300 parsecs. Actually didn't measure, but it's very easy to predict what they should be. This is the correlation you have at accretion. This is the correlation ratio zero because tidal evolution makes it a little bit flatter. And the slope is actually becomes not 0.35, but something more like 0.25, but still there is a slope. But you should remember that there could be a nonlinear relation between luminosity and mass. In fact, faint end of the luminosity function predicts tells us that it should be quite steep. And so if you assume a relation like this with a power of 3 to 4, I would say that this is a pretty good match to the observational result. So you don't need to have a step function. It's enough to have a power of something like 3 to 4 to explain this observational result. So, what it means for the progenitor masses, I think the coccolide progenitors may have total masses which vary up to a factor of 50.
All right. One question? All right, perfectly done, Andre. Next, Laura.
Good afternoon, my name is Laura Sales. We are presenting a poster and the analysis of these galaxies, simulated these galaxies at redshift 2 in the overwhelmingly large simulations. Our sample consists of approximately 150 halos in this mass range that is quoted there, 10 to 11, 5 times 10 to the 12. This is an example in the black figure, is an example of the kind of objects we do have. In green, you see star forming gas particles. You see that we do find some disk-like or rotationally supported objects. So this makes a good comparison. We can make a good comparison against recent observational findings, the kind of symphony galaxies at redshift 2. And for example, we can address the issue of the size-velocity relation of these galaxies. We do find things that are as extended as the observations, so we can characterize their dark matter halos to see whether they are exotics or not. And we do also, from a more theoretical point of view, analyze the relation between the specific angular momentum of the baryons and that one of the dark matter. We can test the predictions like MoMA and White models, and we can also quantify the relative orientation between the spin of these two components.
Questions for Laura? That was great.
Yeah, so what's the answer?
Go into the post. No, it depends. It has a bigger variation, but it peaks around 30 degrees, 30, 50 degrees.
All right, Jason.
A lot. Well, it depends on the SPH implementation. We have several of them, so it depends on the feedback.
All right, thanks, Laura. Everyone go see her poster.
Hello, so I'm not Schoenrich. Ralph Schoenrich was a visiting student in Oxford, and we started this project. He's really in Munich. The idea is to revise classical chemical evolution models of the Milky Way to include the radial migration of stars, and while we were doing that, we thought we should include the radial migration of gas, because it isn't plausible that gas simply falls down in an exponential pattern. In this process, an important point is that inward flow of gas tends to steepen the metallicity gradient. We have quite steep metallicity gradients. That's sort of, we have them separately in alpha elements and in an iron and so on. Okay, the key results that in your classical model you have a well-defined age-metallicity relationship, in the sense that at any given time in the solar neighborhood, stars, the insular medium had a certain metallicity, and therefore the stars that formed at that time had to have this metallicity. I think there's plenty of evidence that that isn't the case. In this model, this is the kind of distribution you get. This is a logarithmic scale of density over there by color, and you can see that the disk, that this is what we would call the thin disk here, but it's a very widespread, and there's no age-metallicity relationship. Next point I would say is that we have achieved a very good fit to the Geneva-Copenhagen sample of solar neighborhood stars. That's shown by this pink line, the data of the green whatevers. And that's the main thing we've fitted to. We also have kept our eye on the Hess diagram. There isn't space to show it here, it isn't shown, but that's reasonably under control. I mean, it is under control too, but the selection effects in the Geneva-Copenhagen survey of how things have been selected in the Hess diagram are a little unclear, so it's difficult to be definitive there. In a sense, I think this is the most important diagram. What it shows is alpha abundance, O over Fe, versus Fe over H. This is the trajectory. So up here is 0.6 in alpha, and this is the trajectory of the solar neighborhood, insular medium, coming down here towards solar. The sun happens to be close to solar. Meanwhile, you have a scattering. This is a model, but these would be the locations of stars in the solar neighborhood at the sun. And so you have a ridgeline up here and a ridgeline down here, thick disk, thin disk, but there was no thick disk and no thin disk, no nonsense like that. This has just been secular heating of the disk, forming stars in a homogeneous way.
Thank you, James. He went over his time, so we're going to have to defer for questions. Why don't you guys listen to me? We're going to have to defer for questions. We got a lot of posters. So Claire,
okay.
Up next. Although we will have that discussion at some point.
Cut into my 2 minutes. All right. I'm Claire Lochner. This is work I did over the summer with Innes Ivins at Carnegie. The title says it all. I think I win the long title award. But what I looked at was a sample of kinematically selected stars by Christine Allen. She looked for stars that were similar in phase space. So these stars have similar orbital energies, angular momentum, and also metallicity. And in this phase space clump, there are two known low alpha stars shown in pink, and you can see the magnesium over iron and against iron there. The comparison sample is from Fulbright 2000. And so I used high-res stellar spectra to get abundances, and in addition to the two known low alpha stars, I found two new low alpha stars, which is exciting because, as I've been asked to emphasize, low alpha stars are rare in the galactic halo, so finding more of them is interesting. And it's also interesting because, given the kinematic relations and the chemical relations, it points to these stars being merger remnants. And we're currently looking at more of these phase space clumps to find more. Questions?
Excellent. Thanks, Claire. Do we have any questions? One question.
What is the... Come look at my poster.
Nice. If you guys would like to use the laser pointer yourselves, you feel free.
So, hello everybody, my name is Facundo Gomez, and together with Amina, we are presenting a poster that is titled Identifying Substructures Through Orbital Frequencies. So the basic idea is to find which is the most suitable space to identify the bridge from emergency event. So the traditional way to do this is by looking at space as velocities or actually an integral of motion space, and I have two examples of this. This is what I'm taking from a simulation of a satellite galaxy being accreted in a Hooke potential, time-independent Hooke potential. So as you can see, in velocity space, we can barely distinguish, in black points are all the particles of the satellites, while in red are the particles inside of the solar neighborhood sphere of 4 kiloparsec radius. So you see here it's very difficult to identify. Here it gets better, but we look at the orbital frequencies. This is a radial frequency and angular frequency. We can actually distinguish every single stream that is in that sphere. We try to see what happened with the time evolution of the host potential. We have an exponential evolution of the mass. The time scale is 3.3 gigahertz, and we follow the evolution for 10 gigahertz. And you can see that still the structure is not destroyed. We can still recover all the streams. So our conclusion are the streams are well-defined and easy to distinguish in this space. Time evolution do not destroy them. And the separation between action and stream is proportional to the time of accretion of the satellite. Right, we try with the full light potential. It's a disk potential of the Milky Way. It's actually a simulation of a formation of a thick disk, and still we can recover, and the edges as well are very well recovered.
One more question? All right,
These are the frequencies in action angle variables. Right, we got the same idea. We went in different ways. Yeah, exactly. He will. Yeah.
All right, thank you, Paco.
Do I just go?
Yeah, I'm ready.
So I'm not quite sure what to do after James Binney steals your thunder, but here goes. So we ran some idealized embodied plus SPH simulations of disk formation. We basically start with a gas halo embedded in an NFW dark matter halo. The gas halo is initially in pressure equilibrium. And then we turn on, when we start the simulation, the cooling allows the disk to collapse at the center. And because we give it initial rotation, it forms a thin disk in the middle. And the important thing to know about these simulations is that we don't make any assumptions about the disk from the beginning. The disk sort of grows spontaneously, governed by feedback and that sort of thing. And we initially started these simulations because we wanted to study outer disk formation. But what we found was, interestingly, was that a lot of these stars can migrate on circular orbits, much like Selwood and Binney explained in 2002. And I just included an example up there. It's kind of an extreme example, but just to make a point, you can see that, so color corresponds to time, blue is early, red is late, and you can see that this star indeed has migrated a great distance, but remained in almost perfectly circular orbit. So what we discuss in my poster and in two published papers is the effects of migration on stellar properties of stellar populations. So in this left panel here, you can see the birth radius distribution of the solar neighborhood, and you can see that it's basically stars can come from all over the place, from the very interior of the galaxy. And this has huge consequences for example, the age-metallicity relation. It broadens it significantly, so in effect, you have no AMR in the end. And also, it impacts in a significant way the metallicity distribution function. So all these diagnostics that people use to sort of tune semi-analytic models of galactic chemical evolution, if you include stellar migration, they're modified quite significantly. And also not shown here, but it's on my poster and also in the papers, this has huge implications for things like determining star radial resolve, star formation histories, as well as abundance gradients in disks.
Thank you, Rock. We have time for a question. Shout it out, Hans Walter. Sorry, Hans Walter.
Rock, let me ask a naive question. If there is a lot of stellar migration, I would expect to see a gradient in metallicity in stars much flatter than in the gas. Whereas it doesn't seem the case, because in the paper of Rushing and Binney, the gradient is almost the same as in the gas. So what does it mean? That the effect is not so important, or that in some way there is some conspiration, and then the stars form a gradient anyway?
Are you referring to metallicity's gradients observed in the Milky Way?
Yeah, because the gradient in the Milky Way from stars are identical to the gradient observed in gas.
Right,
and not only for the stars like the Cepheids, but also for older stars like the open clusters and the planetary nebulae. So I would expect a bigger effect.
The methods used to estimate all those different gradients from all the different kinds of tracers and from the gas are very different. And the and I think the observational scatter there is also very large, so I'm not sure. And it could be an indication that this process is not as important in the Milky Way, but I certainly don't. Anyway, the jury's out.
So there is a conspiracy. The gas and the stars are migrating. Okay, lots of interesting stuff about migration of stars and gas. Thank you, Rock. And now we have Kyle Stewart, who is going to talk about galaxy merger fractions quickly.
Hi, so my name is Kyle Stewart. I'm a graduate student at UC Irvine. My recent work has been on merger histories of Milky Way-sized dark matter halos, specifically looking at disk formation and how disks can still be around with the mergers that Lemnos-y demisets are happening. So this plot shows the fraction of halos versus halo mass that have had a relatively large major merger since redshift 2. As you can see, so for about 10 to the 12 solar mass halos, about 55% have had a major merger since redshift 2. So the question of, you know, why are there a 70% disk fraction in halos of this size is problematic. One possible solution is the idea that maybe gas-rich mergers don't necessarily destroy disks, even if they're major mergers. So in order to investigate this possibility, I kind of have a three-step approach. So the first step is to look at high-resolution M-body simulations to get merger histories of dark matter halos. And then once I have that, I use the results of Conway Wexler 2008, where they use number density matching to assign stellar masses to dark matter halos. And then I go a step further and use observational estimates to get some kind of idea of gas mass for a galaxy with given stellar mass. Now, once I do that, I'm able to assign estimates of gas mass and stellar mass into these halos, and I have all the merger histories. And so you can actually break down the merger fraction into the fraction that are gas-rich versus gas-poor, where I'm just, you know, arbitrarily defining that gas-poor means a gas fraction less than 50%, and gas-rich means a gas fraction greater than 50%. And as you can see, so even though Milky Way-sized halos have had lots of major mergers, or a large fraction of them had at least one major merger since C of 2, most of those have been gas-rich, and so only 20% of Milky Way-sized halos have actually had a gas-poor merger since C of 2. And so maybe this, you know, helps alleviate the problem of, you know, how it just survived a little bit. I also want to point out that so at higher halo mass, so at 10 to the 13, there's a higher fraction of halos that have had a gas poor merger, and so maybe this can help explain why there's a smaller disk fraction percentage at that halo mass.
Thank you, Kyle. Questions? Clapping.
Okay, you better do this one.
Okay, so I'm Annie Robin. I work in Besançon with the people mentioned here, Doug Marshall, Céline Reilly, and Matthias Schulteis. And we are doing galaxy modeling. And what I will show here is how to detect the warp in the stars from 2-mass data and the 2D extinction map of the galaxy. So we did a 3D extinction map of the galaxy in 2006. This is the face-on view of the extinction in the galaxy we published in 2006. And this is a sanity check of the map we did. And we compare with the COE mission, and we find the same region of interstellar matter than we see in CO. And the interesting thing about the work on the warp is that we see the warp in the dust. You can see on both sides here. So then, having this 3D extinction map and the galaxy model, we compare the total counts we see. Thanks. Okay. Sorry. The 2-mass star counts here and the galaxy model on the bottom. And when you compare this region here, you see that the warp in the model is too strong. And this is the H1 model of warp. So the warp seems to be too strong. If we suppose the H1 warp to the stars, it's too strong. So we try to make a more detailed model of the warp. And here at positive longitude, you see a zoom on this map. This is 2-mass, this is the model, this is the residual between both. And you see that at positive longitude, we have a good warp model. And at negative longitude, it does not work. So we see that there is a significant difference between the warp on the side of the galaxy and the other side of the galaxy. So this is not a shape, and it well compares with the H1 warp model that Leo showed early this week. So we try to fit the three Fourier modes, the Levin et al. Model, to the stars, and it ends up that the stellar warp seems to show these 3D modes, but with slightly different slope. It's less strong, and this is a question for the dynamicists to explain this difference between the stellar warp and the H1 warp. And also, the dust warp is shown here is only slightly less marked than the H1 warp, but closer. So it seems that we have strong H1 warp, a little bit less strong in dust, and less marked in the stars.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes, in fact, we have no good model for the negative side. And for the positive side, if we use just a simple S mode, it works. And if we work with a three Fourier mode from Levin, it works as well. But if you see the model of Levin, it's like that. It means that the Fourier mode, the zero order and third and second order Fourier mode, does not play a large role at positive longitude. So this is the place where the warp is well S-shaped. So it works on this side. But on the other side, it's different.
Leo, do you want to shout it out quick?
What's the difference in the amplitude between what you get from the stellar and from the H1? Factor of two?
Factor of two difference between the stellar and the gaseous swarms. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
My name is Colavitti Edoardo, and I will talk about chemical gradients in the Milky Way. As you can see in my poster outside, we have found a cosmological info law derived by the public tricode gadget 2. Which was able to reproduce quite well the main characteristics of the Milky Way, such as, for example, the star formation rate, the type 1a M2 supernovae rate, and the chemical abundances. But this only for the solar neighborhood. As a matter of fact, in the inner part of the Milky Way, we have some problems with the abundance gradients. In the plot on the right, you can see that the red line is the model by Capini et al. 1997, while the green dashed line is our model, while the blue points are the cepheids by compilation by Cescutti et al. 2007. You can see that between 4 and 6 kiloparsecs, our model is completely flat. This behavior was obtained by dividing the galactic disk in 6 different parts and normalization, the info law with 6 different constants. So to solve this problem, we try to develop a new cosmological model, dividing the galactic disk in 3 different parts, finding so a different info law for every shell using the coordinates of every dark matter halo of the main progenitor. So the difference between our old model and this new model is that we have no threshold now in the gas density of the gas, a star formation efficiency that changes with the radius, and an inside-out prescription. So the results can be seen on the left. You can see the data are there. So the blue points are the cepheids, the red one are the B stars. The green points represent H2 regions, while Chan points are open clusters. The black solid line represents our old cosmological model, while the red dashed line, our new model. It's the contrary. So you can see that the black solid line, that is our new model, is less flat. However, we have not a sufficient resolution to capture the inside-out formation of the dark matter halo, so we think that now we have to do a simulation of our dark matter halo.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, we'll clap then, we'll do questions. So clap. We got time constraints here, guys. Questions? Do you really think that's less flat? Is that really for real less flat? I mean, kind of.
Yes, it's not so evident. However, if you are quite close to the plot, you can see it.
Fair enough. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about infrared dark clouds. My name is Doug Marshall. Here's my collaborators. So infrared dark clouds, for those who don't know, they're seen in mid-infrared as extinction features. They're interesting because we think that's where high-mass stars are formed. There's a catalog of 10,000, roughly 10,000 clouds from Simon et al. 2006, and they got kinematic distances for about 300, and Jackson et al. For another couple hundred. And the idea then is to get a distance and a mass to try to understand these clouds as a whole. So I'm bringing a different method, which instead of looking at kinematic distances, is looking at three-dimensional extinction. So here I show a line of sight towards one of these clouds. So distance and these points here show the extinction as it rises, and you can see the cloud is where the extinction rises sharply. And in red here, it's the derivative as a function of distance, so it gives you the dust density along the line of sight. So we can then get the distance by looking just where the extinction rises and looking at a face-on plot of the galaxy with the galactic center here, the sun here. You can see many of these clouds fall along the spiral arms and are concentrated in the molecular ring where there's a bit of maybe confusion between neighboring arms. We can also look at the mass spectrum. So as we have an extinction for each cloud, assuming a gas to dust ratio, we can get the mass. And here is the mass spectrum, which has a slope of minus 1.9, plus or minus 0.1. This puts some intermediate between GMCs, giant molecular clouds, and Bok globules. And it's close to an initial cluster mass function. So it does seem to be compatible with areas where we'll have high mass stars forming in clusters. Comparing to the kinematic distances, here I'm showing my extinction and my distance determined from the extinction, the kinematic distance, and you can see that there is scatter, but globally, where they find a bigger extinction, so do I, a bigger distance, so do I. But this is a very difficult area to use kinematic distances because we're looking at spiral shocks, which introduce velocity perturbations. So I've done this for just over 1,000 clouds, and there are a few other details on my poster. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. One question. Krumholtz, shout it out.
Senator, you revised mass estimates. Does the total mass of IRBC in the galaxy go up or down compared to the last draft one?
There's a mass estimate of the...
The total mass of all the IRBCs in the galaxy, there's an estimate in draft form and paper where they are connected. Is your total mass budget in IRBC higher or lower, and by how much?
I haven't looked at the total mass. I can say that the average mass for these clouds is very similar. It's in the 3,000 to 5,000 solar masses. But I didn't look at the total mass. Yeah. Sorry. I forgot to say. Interesting question.
We'll take your word on that, Mark. No. Just kidding. Okay, thank you very much, Doug. Jennifer Johnson.
So I have a poster up on a project that I'm working on with many people, including specifically Judy Cohen, Andy Gould, Josh Simon also got us some of our first data for this project, so thank you. The plan is to use the magnification caused by gravitational lensing when a lens passes between us and a star in the bulge, most specifically a dwarf. And in our case, we're going after events where the magnification means that we're getting 100 times the flux. And this is great because we can then get a spectrum, a high-resolution spectrum of a bulge dwarf in a reasonable exposure time. And the particular reason why we're interested in this is that we've seen a ton of beautiful, beautiful work on understanding the bulge by looking at high-resolution spectra of giants. And we'd like to see whether or not the dwarfs give us the same answer. In particular, dwarfs are at a different stage of their evolution. And if you look over here, at the Google Sky plot over here on the right, you'll see that there are different locations. So the green point on the right is the galactic center. The other green point is Botta's window. And the other multicolored points indicate places where we have high resolution data from microlens dwarfs. And you can see they're scattered all throughout the bulge. As has been mentioned a couple of times, one of the most interesting things that's come out of it so far is that the dwarf metallicity distribution function, admittedly from three events that we've published so far, is higher than the giant metallicity distribution function. We have four events that various people are currently analyzing, and three of the events
like to be over here, and there's one kind of hanging out there. That's the preliminary analysis. So, so far the other events that we've looked at agree with the overall dwarfs like to be supersolar picture. One thing we are currently working on is trying to understand any impact that the microlensing event can cause. And this is a plot here from Subo Dong, who's a graduate student at Ohio State. And in this particular plot, he's plotted for a whole bunch of 5-minute intervals, one of the most extreme events that we have a high, the most extreme event that we have a high resolution spectrum of. And so the plot along here is the radius of the star, and the plot along here is the magnification. And you can see that at different times as the event happens, this particular event had a caustic crossing, the limb is brightened more relative to the center, and then that changes as the event progresses. However, when we actually do the analysis, we get a very small change in spectrum. You'll have to go look at the poster to see some samples, and we're currently quantifying the change that will lead to in the metallicity. But given that this is a most extreme event, I think it's safe to say that this is not a problem for our abundance analysis.
Thank you, Jennifer. Claps. Okay, what's up with the bulge dwarfs? Shout it out, Rich.
So my one comment is that the star that's hanging out right here, again, preliminary analysis, is the one that's right up there next to Botta's window. So everything, you know, the rest of the bulge likes to be over here, according, you know, but so, I mean, I really want to see, and again, I think it's great that you're getting data all throughout the bulge, because I think that's one of the things that's going to be really interesting. Yeah.
Thank you, Jennifer. Everyone check out that poster.
Hi, I'm Allison Brooks. I'm going to be talking to you today about some work I've done on gas accretion in disk galaxy simulations. And this is motivated by the fact that semi-analytic models always adopt the temperature for the gas in the halo starts off at the virial temperature before it cools onto the disk. But there's been some recent theoretical work that shows that maybe that's not always the case. And in particular, Dushan Karas and his collaborators a couple years ago looked at a large cosmological volume of simulated galaxies and showed that a lot of the gas came into the galaxy cold and never reached the virial temperature. But because they were running a large cosmological volume, they couldn't resolve individual disks. So I extended that work here to 4 very high resolution disk galaxy simulations where we can now see what happens to that gas as it flows onto the disk. All right, so these masses here are the virial masses of these halos, and they correspond also up here, the same boxes. So these 2 lower mass galaxies here are dominated at all times by cold gas accretion. And this actually isn't necessarily so surprising. This is already in the semi-analytic models where up until a certain mass, you're not actually massive enough to support a stable shock and build a hot halo because your cooling times are so short. And so, for instance, this one doesn't actually develop a hot halo until a redshift of about a half. But these two, where we have a Milky Way mass galaxy and 3 times the mass of the Milky Way, are actually dominated over most of their history by hot gas accretion. So in these simulations, I can then say, where are the disk particles that are born from this gas? And that's what I'm showing you down here. So for the stars that are in the disk at redshift 0, these are the resulting star formation rates. And right, so I should probably explain that the green is clumpy gas accretion. It's gas that came in mergers. And the blue is unshocked cold gas accretion that was smoothly accreted to the galaxy. Red is stuff that came in smooth but got shocked, reached temperatures approaching the virial temperature. And you can see that in particular for these 2 more massive galaxies, even though they've been dominated by shocked gas accretion over most of their history, in fact, for the Milky Way, this is instead dominated by cold gas accretion in the disk. And for this more massive one here, there's a burst of star formation early on that's due to this cold gas accretion. And if I can just eat into my time a little bit, I just wanted to show what would happen if that cold gas behaved like the hot gas. I just actually said, what happens if it reached the same temperature? What would the cooling time be on the disk? And it turns out that the disk formation gets delayed until after redshift 1.
Thank you very much, Allison.
Sorry.
Okay, now Beth Willman. Are there any questions for Allison first? Shout it out, Connie.
That's what I'm saying, yes.
So you want to take the observed population of Milky Way dwarf galaxies and compare them with your model predictions, or you want to make your own predictions for what's the luminosity function of ultra-faint dwarfs, or how many things might be there for us to detect in future surveys. And to do this, you need a very well-characterized selection function. Now, the detectability of dwarfs is a function of lots of things, like distance, luminosity, size, the direction through the galaxy that you're looking. And this paper that we have that's about to be accepted to AJ, we're going to provide in the electronic journal version these very detailed selection function for anyone to go and download to make your own assumptions with and play around with to compare with your models. If you're willing to make the probably wildly incorrect some assumptions about the relationship between size and luminosity of the systems, you can take these linear fitting functions right from our paper, which gives the distances at which you detect dwarfs at 50%, 90%, and 99% as a function of their luminosity. And in the very near future, there's going to be more things in SDSS, like most of us know about. We'll be able to test the all-important spatial distribution in 3D of these things with the Southern Sky Survey, which is going to be done on the SkyMapper telescope to start in survey mode and sometime in 2009, PI'd by Helmut Jurgen. There's 15 of us who will be searching that for dwarfs. And James Bullock and I are co-chairs of the Milky Way and Local Group Structure Science Collaboration with LSST. And so if anyone's interested in talking with us about that, then please do while we're all still here. Thanks.
Thank you, Beth. Questions for Beth? Well, thank you for providing these selection functions.
Have we got a pointer?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about driving star formation history for a particular dwarf spiral galaxy. This is not the brightest, not certainly one of the ultra-faint ones, sort of a medium one. The LEO 1 dwarf spiral galaxy, it's out at a distance of 270 kiloparsecs, quite far from the center of the Milky Way. Here's our new ACS data, which has totally revolutionized our understanding of the star formation history. We had some old WIFPIC data that basically detected stars down to here, and inferred the presence of these from the giant branch. And this is a simulated CMD of what we would have gotten with our project. If that WIFPIC 2 derived star formation history is true, we'd have gotten a lot of stars piled here at 3 billion years, because that's when the derived peak of the star formation history was. Instead, much to our surprise, the peak is very old, down here 13, 17 billion years for the ages. But again, nearly continual star formation all the way up to just a billion years ago in this dwarf spiral galaxy, which is really hard to reproduce in a lot of the hierarchical formation simulations. So getting really accurate data here is very good to constrain cosmology with these things. Now, in comparison, here's some new data from the ELSID collaboration, Cole et al., on LEO A. It's a dwarf irregular galaxy, which about the same absolute magnitude as this dwarf spheroidal. So this one has gas, this one does not. And surprisingly, you do see a very small component of old stars, but the peak of the star formation there is up in this sort of 5 to 8 billion years. Okay, so these guys have very different star formation histories, and in fact, the dwarf spheroidal has different star formation histories when we really get accurate data and resolve this region of the diagram. Because here is where the age information is. This is mostly metallicity information here and here, and that's all.
Thank you, Tammy.
Results, and they said that there had been a dispersal star formation which dated the time of the LEO 1 came by the Milky Way and all that got in the middle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you notice, there's some hint of, it probably doesn't appear in this resolution, but some hint of the same kind of thing you see in Carina. In Carina, there are stars that are just missing here. There's a big gap in here. But you see there's a little bit of overdensity there, too. Well, you can, by eye, just read it off of here, about 5 billion years. So interesting behavior, but very hard to produce. The other thing that's very hard to produce is the fact that this is nearly a constant metallicity. And that's something you see generically in dwarf galaxies, that they quickly rise to a mean metallicity that reflects their, that's reflective of their total luminosity at the present day. So there's a very flat age-metallicity relationship in all these galaxies, which if you want to start breaking things up and making halos, gives you a lot of information of what kind of mass things could have been mixed up in the Milky Way halo to form it.
Okay, thank you very much, Tammy. Everyone check out that poster on LEO. Claps again.
Hello, I'm Kevin Schlafman. I'm a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz working with Connie Rockesy, and we conducted a systematic statistical search for cold substructure in the Segway metal poor main sequence turnoff star radial velocity database. Now, because this search is both statistical and systematic, we can accurately estimate both our completeness and false positive rate. So basically, it's more than stamp collecting. You can get all of the details in a moderate resolution version on my poster. A slightly higher resolution version will be available shortly once we submit it to AppJ. But the main results are we find 11 new candidate elements of cold substructure in the inner halo. We can set a 95% upper limit on the fraction of metal poor main sequence turnoff stars in cold substructure in the inner halo of 0.1%. Now, this is in reasonable agreement with the Aquarius result, and hopefully that's not too surprising, even though their result is for bound substructures. The multiplier to go from bound substructures to recently disrupted is about a few, so they're in the same ballpark. We also would like to make the point that it's difficult to connect the things that we observe to particular disruption events because we have very little information. We basically just have, for the time being, the positions on space of the detections and the radial velocities that characterize them, so it's hard to connect it to particular accretion events. We also find that there is not much of a reason to reject a smooth distribution for the metal poor main sequence turnoff stars because that smooth kinematic distribution produces a radial velocity distribution, which we basically observe to be very similar to what we observe in the radial velocity database in most cases. So the smooth model is not really rejected by our result. And finally, these observations are consistent with the models of inner halo formation put forward by, again, the Aquarius project, by Via Lactea group, and by Johnson and Bullock, that the halo formed relatively early by a few massive dark matter halos, and then because of that, you have some violent relaxation, you have lots of time for phase mixing, and so things get mostly smoothed out. That's it.
Thank you, Kevin. Questions for Kevin? Questions for Kevin. Shout it out.
So again, that's very tenuous, but they're both collisionless for the most part, and so that's it.
Do they have stars or not? I mean, it's not necessarily. It depends on the mass to light ratio of the object and so on. So it's not necessarily the one-to-one mapping between dark matter and.
So the statement that I'm repeating is that this is our observation. The observation from the Aquarius project is they see something like 0.1% in the solar circle in bound substructure. And I'm noting that these things are not too disseparate. Also keeping note of the thing that the multiplier to go from bound substructure to things that were not so recently disrupted is only a few. And so it's not so surprising that these numbers are close together.
How to go from dark matter to stars. I think that's a key question we should all be talking about. Thank you very much, Kevin. Next up is Ines Evans.
Hi. So I want to tell you about a couple of stellar systems that look like they're modern-day relics of the kind of things that made up the halo at earlier times. Not shown here, but what I want to mention are results on Boötes 1, one of the new ultra dwarfs. This work involves Andy McWilliam, Marla Jiha, and a cast of thousands. We have abundances for stars in this system that look like they just came out of the Milky Way, with the exception of a high europium abundance, which is quite unusual, and I'm happy to talk to people about it afterwards. What I wanted to spend the rest of the time on, as much as it is NGC 5466, the globular cluster in the outer part of our halo. The abundances for this cluster argue against the thing that was mentioned on Monday, that the abundance anomalies evidence in globular clusters says that they could not have made up the halo of our Milky Way. Shown in the top right panel, you see for a number of globular clusters that are sort of linear in metallicity but show these huge ranges in their oxygen abundances compared to the same metallicity range in the field for halo stars. Halo stars do not show significant range in oxygen. The globular clusters do. And this is also seen in oxygen versus sodium. So this is when the people talk about abundance anomalies, this is the kind of thing they're talking about. This large range in anticorrelated oxygen and sodium abundances in globular clusters that is not seen in the field. These are old results for a lot of globular clusters that were studied in the early 90s. More recently plotted here, you see extending out to the outer halo systems as well as systems with tidal tails. We also show this oxygen-sodium anticorrelation, but in NGC 5466 we don't. NGC 5466 is one of these clusters that was found in the coplanar alignment on the sky by Yun and Lee back in 2002. It also has these tidal tails extending for great distances, losing a lot of stars. It has a very strange luminosity function where it really looks like there has been stratification of the more massive stars being stripped from the globular cluster. And so it looks like perhaps systems like this lurking in the outskirts of our halo may be what's left of what made up the halo in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Question? Rosie.
Perry Center. I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm sorry, I don't know. I was looking for clusters that were spending lots of time in the outer halo. I'm assuming that they're going to have closer in Perry Centers, but I don't actually know. It couldn't be too close in, or else, at least in this case, you'd think it'd be disrupted a long time ago.
Okay, Andre, got to yell.
I'm sorry, I didn't know which figure you were pointing at. The top right. There is a scatter in each of the globular clusters that it seems unique to the globular cluster. The halo, yes. I'm only going as low as the globular clusters' metallicities go. I can't show any globular clusters that have lower metallicities. They just simply don't exist. Minus 2.5-ish is about the lowest metallicity globular cluster we've observed. Judy? The reason for the oxygen-sodium correlation, I think there's four camps, and people are still occupying various one of them, so there's not a conversion yet. Intrinsic, extrinsic, self-pollution, and primordial. Intrinsic, the stars are undergoing proton capture nucleosynthesis as they evolve up the giant branch. This has been argued against theoretically because the modelers cannot get stars to become hot enough in their interiors to do this. Extrinsically, some people have suggested that the pollution is effect of globular cluster passing through the disk and being polluted by disk gas. However, if you think about it, this is when the globular clusters are going their fastest. It's least likely they're going to be collecting anything. They're just going to be stripping it. Self-pollution, the argument is that you need 2, 3, 4, 5 solar mass AGB stars to have polluted a lot of CNO material onto which was deposited onto the atmospheres of the stars we observe now. That's something that IGB modelers predict. However, the people who do star formation for a living say that, like Bruce Almagreen says, that you would need such a funky IMF, you would never observe such a thing. And then finally, primordial, you say, well, you were born like that. But that just steps the problem back, and someone else has to go look for an answer.
Excellent. Thank you, Ennis.
My name is Evan Kirby. I'm a dissertation year graduate student at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And the names, other names that should be on this plot are my advisor, Raja Guatakrata, also Marla Jiha, Josh Simon, Anna Frabel, and Chris Needon. I can thank Josh for introducing the concept of getting metallicities from DMOS spectra. So we have a large database of DMOS spectra, which I'll show you in the next slide. And he introduced them in the context of building the Milky Way halo metallicity distribution, as many other speakers in this conference have done. But these dwarf spherules are interesting in and of themselves. I can thank Tammy for introducing LEO-1. It's been known from photometry for almost a decade that LEO-1 has a population gradient, namely that the inner stars look somewhat different from the outer stars. And it wasn't known whether or not this was attributable to age or metallicity, but I can at least attribute it in part to metallicity from these spectroscopic abundances. So you can see that because DMOS is a multi-object medium resolution spectrometer, you can get a great deal of spectra with useful for getting these abundances out of. So you can see that LEO-1 has this nice population gradient as you go from the inner parts of it to the outer parts of it. But metallicity isn't the only thing that you can, or a one-dimensional metallicity isn't the only thing you can get out of these spectra. There's plenty of other element lines to go around, as we heard from Rave and Apogee and all these other large surveys that are targeting halo stars to get many multi-dimensional abundances. Well, I'm trying to do this for the dwarf spheroidals. So this is just a listing of the catalog of individual stars in dwarf spheroidals that I can hope to get both metallicities, meaning iron, and alpha enhancements out of to be able to compare to the Milky Way halo, exactly as Catherine suggested in her talk this morning. She showed this nice plot of alpha versus iron. And is that really consistent with the things that built our galaxy? Well, we don't have the things that built our galaxy. We have the things that still live today. So is it possible to construct the alpha versus iron diagram from the halo from these components? Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Questions for Evan?
Do you know what it looks like yet? You've got a lot of acquired here.
For one thing, some of these were acquired last night or two nights ago, and the others were acquired very recently. And I'm applying for jobs, and I don't have time to do anything.
Excellent, thank you, Evan. Any more questions, Brian? Clap your hands.
All right. So my name is Joe Wolf. I just want to thank Juniper for doing this. She put a lot of work into this. I kept sending her more and more slides, and she kept putting them in. So,
no problem.
So, not to open up a can of worms again from this morning, but the title of my talk is The Mass of Dispersion-Supported Systems Using the Two-Component Analysis and Making a Stand Against Unnecessarily Long Titles. James Bullock is my advisor. He put my picture up in the talk today, so I thought it was only fair that I put his picture up today in his talk. This is from the UCI press release about the Nature paper. So this is Team Irvine here. We have Team Irvine and collaborators Lou Shagari, a former member of Team Irvine. I really want to point out Marla and Josh because they really helped motivate this result and the importance of it and what I'm about to show. So two plots. When people talk about these dwarf spheroidals, and when you look and you see these blobs of stars in the sky, and you ask, what's the mass inside of the stellar radius? And what you have here is plotted from our mass modeling that Louis and Manoj and James and I have done, is the mass from the stellar extent versus this quantity sigma squared r core. And this black line is a commonly accepted approximation called the Illingworth approximation. It was derived back in 1976 or so for globular clusters. And it's a one-component fit. It assumes mass falls late. And as you can see, the line doesn't really match the data all that well. It's about an order of magnitude off. And so what we're proposing is to look at mass in a slightly different way, to talk about the mass within the half-light radius. And there's two reasons for this that are interrelated. One, the stellar extent of these dwarf spheroidals is not well-constrained, especially for the new ones, whereas the half-light radius actually is a bit more well-constrained. And you can see by the error bars here, are just much better. And this line here, and the globular cluster is on the bottom left, and this line here is essentially the Virial theorem, and you see excellent agreement with the central velocity dispersion times the 3D half-light radius versus the mass within half-light radius. And so we're kind of pushing, if new dwarfs are found with Pan-STARRS and AllSkyMapper and all those, I don't know if I mispronounced that, but with those, if you want to go and find the masses really quickly just from the dispersion, boom, you know, here you have an equation that can give you the mass and the half-light radius. And so, oh, and for a range of different profiles, you know, you have Plummer and exponentials and kings. Whenever you do the 3D integration, whenever you do the Abel inversion, you always get that the half-life radius is about 1.32 times the 2D half-life radius. So it's a quick and easy calculation. It works incredibly well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any questions for Joe?
I guess the can of worms is not back open back there.
Thank you very much, Joe. And up next is Sanjeev Sharma.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm Sanjeev Sharma. Let's see. Okay. So my poster is about group finding in multidimensional data sets and its application to galactic archaeology. So it's basically a hierarchical multidimensional group finder. Hierarchical by mean it can find groups, subgroups, sub-subgroups, and so on. And it has also a built-in significance estimator, so you can get rid of spurious groups also, and it automatically takes care of measurement errors also. So one of the problems that you face when you work in multiple dimensions is how do you scale different dimensions? For example, you might have 3D coordinates and then radial velocity or abundance of elements and so on and so forth. So the question is, what's the ideal metric for such a space, given space? So we use the idea of Shannon entropy to actually calculate a locally adaptive distance metric for each data point, so as to extract maximum information from the data. And so it can be applied to numerical simulations of structure formation or to identify structures in astronomical surveys or as a general purpose data mining tool. So I have applications here of it on two mass data. This is a two mass M giant data. And this is the results of the group finders. The different groups are color coded here. In addition to the known groups, we find some new groups here. And this is for results of Gaia. So we generated some synthetic surveys from simulations of Bullock and Johnston. And so what you would see with Gaia, maybe 10 years down the line, I have the results now, if you believe them. So here are shown the number of size of the groups with the precision of the group. So in simulations, we know if you have a group, like what fraction of the stars came from a single satellite. So that is what is precision. So it's plotted precision versus the size of the group here. So this is for various dimensions. 3D space, 4D space, where you have radial velocity, or you have abundance of elements, 6D space, or if you have all the six components, as the three components of velocity and three spatial components. So here you can see in this, with the six-dimensional full phase space, you can get like 37 groups, and these are all unbound structures. And these, on general, come from eight unique satellites. This is what you expect to see. So that.
Oh, really fast. I probably should know the answer, but so when you have you done what? So Catherine asked about dark matter substructure versus stellar substructure. Have you actually looked at for the dark matter clumps in our simulations?
No, I haven't looked at the dark matter clumps yet. But yeah, we are planning to. That would be interesting. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Sanjeev again. Jinwan. Next up, we have Jinwan Choi talking about satellite mass loss.
Hi. Yes, my name is Jinwan Choi, and throughout this conference, people talking about the satellite mass loss and substructure and substructure disruption, and one of the fundamental physics is our understanding of the satellite mass loss is so correct, then we don't have to worry about that. And we did some of the simulation, very high resolution simulation, and our common belief of the satellite disruption is tidal truncation and gravitational shock. So I applied some analytic model for the satellite for the tidal truncation. The mass loss is like that. And I applied the impulse approximation for reproduce the gravitational shock. The mass loss is like that. And there is some discrepancy. And this discrepancy, we believe, this is what so-called resonance torque effect, which is when Sella is rotating, with changing the table, Sella is in the Sella rotating table, the rotating frame, there is the host halo is rotating. This host halo rotating frequency and Sella oil frequency can couple, and host halo host halo can give the angular momentum. Giving this angular momentum can excite the cell light by the resonance interaction. Then this effect can compensate this amount of the mass loss. Our motivation of this simulation, we pre-examine whether this simulation is resolution is high enough to reproduce the resonance interaction. Then we run the very high resolution simulation, such as 10, for the single cell light, I use 10 to the 6 particle with a very noise-free like numerical algorithm. Then I found that this amount of the discrepancy is due to the resonance resonance torque, and our current understand of the cell light disruption maybe need some question. Whether our semi-IT model or some poor resolution simulation is really correctly produced the cell line mass loss. This is fundamental question about the entire fanciness of this substructure and the tidal tail, and I want to brought some attention. There is some more potential physical process which disrupt the cell light.
Thank you, Jinwan. Questions? James Taylor, shout it out.
This is the eccentric orbit, and the eccentricity is about the 0. I forgot number two, but the circularity, the angular momentum, this angular momentum over the circular orbit angular momentum is 0.55, which is assessed by the 1999 Moore's group, the average the angular eccentricity about the substructures. So it's about 0.5 eccentricity.
Any more questions?
So is there a number of particles you need in order to resolve this? I mean, how does...
Yeah, number of particles, there is no golden ruler of this number of particles. We need to calculate the number of particles depend on the situation, but in this case, I guess 10 to the 6 or 10 to the between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 is okay resolution for the cell light, for single cell light, and this is 10 to the 6 single cell light.
Okay, thank you very much, Jinwan.
Hi, so, hi Tom. Okay, great. So I'm Andrew Cooper. I'm a postgrad student from Durham in the UK. This is just an advert for some work that I've been doing with the Aquarius simulation. So this morning you should have learned all you want to know about Aquarius. Six simulations at very high resolution of dark matter halos comparable to the Milky Way. And so what I'm doing is to try and predict the stellar distributions that we would expect in these halos. So build the merger trees from the simulations, and you run on those merger trees a semi-analytic model, in our case Galform, but in principle you could use any model you want. And that model of course will predict the star formation histories of all of the dark subhalos that do form any stars. The crucial point of what I'm doing is to try and map that star formation in the semi-analytic models back to dark matter particles in the simulation. In other words, to pick for any given stellar population that forms a set of dark matter traces that closely, or as closely as possible, approximates what we would think of as perhaps the distribution function of those stars. So having chosen those dark matter traces, you can follow them through the various snapshots of the simulation, and at redshift zero you can see how they're distributed. And of course you recover all of the various components that we've heard so much about, the streams, the satellites, and perhaps a smoother halo component. So once you have these models, similar in many ways to the Bulk and Johnson models that a lot of people will be familiar with, but here in a fully cosmological context and resolved on very small scales, You can ask all sorts of questions. As we know, you can look at the distribution of the stars themselves. You know, these are just fiducial models that we have up here, but you know, we recover power law halos, we can recover metallicity distributions, we can look at where the old stars are, and so on and so forth. So essentially, if you're an observer and you're getting some data over the next few months or year and you want an alternative simulation to compare to, then please give us a call. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Any questions?
Okay, so that's the crucial part of this method, right? It's represented by a little question mark here, because that's what we're spending a lot of time trying to get right. I can tell you how we are going to do it, but I would have to kill you afterwards. These plots were produced by taking something very simple. We just picked the most bound 10% of stars, but we are going to try out multiple methods for doing this.
So do you get the surviving satellite population right?
Sure. Well, do we get it right?
How many do you?
Do we get a surviving satellite population? Yeah. So we get. So that in our models is a constraint, because what we're primarily interested in is the structure of the halo. So the way that we're doing this is to constrain choices like this one by how well we match the structure of the surviving satellites.
So in other words, by definition.
Essentially, yeah.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
So, hello. My name is Rainer Clement. I'm going to talk about my stamp collection, namely the halo streams in the 7th SCSS data release. This is work done in collaboration with, of course, my supervisor, Hans Walter, and Chris Flynn from Finland, and Burkhard Fuchs from the ARI in Heidelberg. Now, our goal was to find substructure in the phase space distribution of solar neighborhood stars, which are metal poor, and to find them directly in phase space. To do this, we used a sample of roughly 22,000 Segre stars, which are nearby and metal poor, and for which we have the full 60 phase space information, plus metallicities, of course. So our search strategy is based on finding overdensities in space banned by the effective integrals of motion, angular momentum, eccentricity of an orbit, and orbital inclination. This is because stellar streams consist of stars moving on similar orbits, and looking in this space has two advantages. First of all, these quantities are immune to phase mixing. So if you look for streams in the inner halo, they are all phase mixed. You can't detect them directly in velocity space. So you look in this space. And second, if you assume an spherical potential and use a formalism introduced by Decker in 1976, then you can express those quantities by some combination of the Cartesian velocity components, U, V, and W. This is shown exemplarily in this plot here for stars in the metallicity range between -1 and -1.5 dex. And each panel, so different panels show the distribution of stars in different narrow slices of orbital inclination. So we have between 0 and 30 degrees and so on. This is a distribution of stars in the azimuthal velocity, which corresponds directly to the total angular momentum. And this quantity is related to the eccentricity of the orbit. So you have the low eccentricity stars below here. And you see, for example, clearly the signal of the thick disk, and a lot of substructure. So we have marked with crosses all features that are already known from the literature. And besides that, we find at least five new features. For example, in this plot, you can see three of them. It's the feature named C1, then R2, and C2 here. So by looking at the metallicity and velocity distribution of the of those features, we find that they are consistent with being of a tidal origin, or at least belonging to the halo. For example, we have also the stream found by Amina in 1999 in our sample here, and we show the show the metallicity distribution of this stream in this plot. And you see it's a rather broad metallicity distribution, but it has one single peak. So as a result, we find at least five new streams with metallicities in the range between roughly minus 1.5 and minus 2 dex, and they all have halo-like kinematics. And besides that, we confirm the existence of the already known streams in the solar neighborhood. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Well, I just have a quick question. Did you actually need 70? I mean, wouldn't the 60 have been okay?
Yeah, the seventh dimension is this here.
Right, I know.
So you first identify them in phase space, and then you look at the metallicity
distribution. But if you don't have metallicities for everything, it looks like you can see the concentrations pretty well in 60. Would you disagree?
Yeah, right.
Okay. But
we have, in total, we have four plots of four slices in metallicity. So,
Catherine.
Ah, good question. I think it's comparable. I think it's even more. So, from a look at the plot, it's even more. Because all this stuff at higher orbital inclinations is lumpy. So we only have a smooth component here in the disk.
Okay, thank you very much, Rainer.
Yep.
Hello. So my name is Sergei Kopasov. I'm a PhD student in Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg. And I'm going to quickly present you the poster on the quantitative explanation of the observed population of Milky Way satellite galaxies. So basically, the purpose of that work was that we tried to understand whether that set of recent discoveries of faint dwarf galaxies, which almost doubled the known population of dwarf galaxies, and our current understanding of incompleteness of such searches for dwarf galaxies is consistent with simple semi-analytical models of Milky Way satellite population. So how we did that, basically? So the goal was we tried to understand whether the missing satellite problem still exists or not with new data. So we started from just pure dark matter only simulation, which we started to populate with stars using some set of recipes. We used rather simplistic recipes, which included, for example, the reionization. So like here. So when, for example, the halos which were smaller than a certain circular velocity were not allowed to form stars after the epoch of reionization. So we used these recipes to populate all the halos and subhalos with stars, and we basically, after that, to that population of galaxies, we applied our knowledge of incompleteness of SDSS, and that allowed us to basically construct the mock SDSS surveys, and we tried to basically compare the number of galaxies of different luminosities and different velocity dispersion to what we see now in SDSS. And I just show here a few examples of the distribution in luminosity of the simulated galaxies and what we see in observations. We can also compare the number of galaxies of different velocity dispersions. And that basically gives us the opportunity to constrain somehow the process of the formation of dwarf galaxies. So if you are interested in what we can derive from that information, you can go to look at my poster. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergei. Questions?
So the velocity dispersion plot,
yeah,
is that the velocity dispersion in the dark matter?
and all that of stars. So we basically we take the potential of the dark matter and put the stars into it and solve the Jeans equation to determine the velocity dispersion.
So how do you know the sizes of the galaxies?
From the observation we know the size as a function of luminosity roughly. So we basically say that for bright dwarfs the size is not like say 100 parsecs or 200 parsecs, and for small ones it's like 50 or 30, which roughly consistent with the current measurements.
Okay, let's thank Sergey again. Now, actually, Michiko Fuji is going to go at the end because she has a file that I couldn't get to work on my computer, so we're going to hear from Jana Grishevich.
Hi, I'm Jana Grishevich. I'm from University of Michigan, and I work with Mary Putman, who's at Columbia University. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is finding the H1 limits for the ultrafaint dwarfs. So I looked in the high pass and the lab data in the directions of these dwarfs, and I found that none of them had H1 except for Leo T, and the detection limits were very low. Some, for Segway, it was as low as 13 solar masses, and some of the more further ones were at about 10 to the 4 solar masses. When we put this information together with what was already known about the H1 content of local group dwarfs, what I plotted here is the H1 mass of the dwarfs versus their galactocentric distance, either to the Milky Way or Andromeda, whichever is closer. And the arrows, which are, I'm sure, a bit hard to see, but these are all upper limits for, so these are undetected in H1. And those right here are primarily Andromeda dwarfs, so they have higher limits just because of their distance. And you can see that there's a cutoff, so at about a galactocentric distance of about 270 kiloparsecs, we find that those that are within that are primarily undetected in H1 to levels that are below that of any of the ones that are further than that that have known H1. And those that are further away are primarily detected at levels above 10 to the 5 solar masses. So it appears that there's some sort of a factor that's distance dependent that's causing this gas loss. And it's also we've looked at this with respect to the total masses of these dwarfs, and it doesn't appear to be a simple scaling with either mass or luminosity that's causing the gas loss. For example, Leo T, which has a total mass of about 10 to the 7, has 10 to the 5 solar masses of H1. And so when you look at this, the most likely explanation for this is Ram pressure stripping. So what you can do with this is you can make estimates of the density of the hot halo gas of the Milky Way that could cause stripping in these dwarfs. So if you assume that these started out with typical dwarf characteristics for example, Leo T, and then they are coming into the galaxy, they would be stripped via Ram pressure stripping. So when you input the typical dwarf characteristics as well as the velocities, which you can get from proper motions, we got these from Piatek, and also look at they've also done orbital analyses for these, you can find out what you would expect the density of the Milky Way's hot halo, what it would have to be in order for these things to be stripped at their perigalacticon. And so you can find lower limits for the hot halo gas of the Milky Way. And so that's what's plotted here. And you can see that we get, these are for the four galaxies, Carina, Ursa Minor, Sculptor, and Fornax. And we get halo densities of about a few times 10 to the negative 4 per cubic centimeter at roughly 70 to 120 kiloparsecs. And again, it's very uncertain because the orbits are also quite uncertain, but there are very few constraints on the halo density at such large distances. So with more information, more proper motion measurements, we can hopefully pin this down. These are limits. Yep. So this is what you get if you assume that these things have typical characteristics before they come in, and then what the halo density would have to be in order for them to be stripped. So.
All right. Thank you very much, Gina. Shout it out, Jeff. No, she's right here.
It's yes. Yeah, right. If you're extrapolating, that's the problem, is that there are very few measurements further than 50 kiloparsecs. What I plotted on the thing were several theoretical estimates, and it actually is consistent with the. It's very hard to see. I'm sorry about this, but here is a recent theoretical model from Kaufman, and so it's marginally consistent. Yeah, yes it is, a lot of variance. Yeah. The Magellanic clouds are a little tricky because it's hard to find the difference, you know, what's being stripped by ram pressure stripping and what's being done by tidal, so. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not sure about that. No, I have to look at that. I'm not sure about the numbers there. Okay. Yeah. It's high, yeah. It's on the high end of the estimate.
Okay, exciting. Limits on the halo. Paul McMillan is going to tell us about how we disassemble the galaxy.
Okay, hi, thank you. I'm talking about disassembling the galaxy. We're using angle action coordinates. For those of you who are not familiar with these, the actions are integrals of the motion. So in an axisymmetric system, one of them is one component of the angular momentum. The angles increase linearly with time with a known frequency. When we say disassembling the galaxy, what we're talking about is finding the remnants of satellite galaxies that have been stripped in the solar neighborhood to determine the angles and actions. We use the torus machinery, which you'll be hearing a great deal more about tomorrow from James, so I won't talk about it now. So we ran simulations, n-body simulations, and stripped a satellite in the potential of a Milky Way, a realistic Milky Way potential. Then we took stars from this small red circle, which described the solar neighborhood. And we found that the remnants from the satellite found in that region were also found in patches in both frequency space, which is on the left here, and then action space on the right there. The satellite was released in the plane of the galaxy, and the orbit was in the plane of the galaxy. So the frequencies here are the radial frequency and the azimuthal frequency, and the actions here are also the azimuthal action, which is the angular momentum, and the radial action. However, you can get a better view of the division into patches in action space. In fact, if you use a different projection, which we in this case found by eye, but you can find it by knowledge of the frequencies. So in that way, action space could be even more useful than frequency space for finding substructure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Sanjib, quick question.
What I'm guessing is, you should also add observational errors and see if, like, the structures that are seen here are really preserved after adding the errors.
I've actually been starting to do that within the last week or so. The Torus Machinery project is a large one with many different things we're looking into, and when I say we, I mostly mean me. So there's things that fall through the cracks, but that is something we've already started looking at, and it's thus far encouraging. Encouraging in action space rather than frequency space.
It's very interesting.
Oh. Okay, that was everyone has the same question. Catherine, quick.
Well, one particular advantage is that the actions are adiabatic invariants, and energy, of course, isn't. So that's one big plus. This is a rather atypical usage for the Torus machinery, so there are other uses for that than this, for which it'll be even more. Don't know yet. Well, yeah, this is too, because we have.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Okay, our penultimate talk will be Jason Tomlinson.
Right, so it's fitting that I'm coming near the very end because this is not a highlight of ongoing work, but rather a preview of coming attractions. This is a meeting devoted to big G galaxy formation, and I don't go to all the meetings on little G galaxy formation, but my friends who do tell me that the big question they're all asking themselves is, how does gas get into galaxies? We've heard a little bit about this earlier in the week. Actually, Allison Brooks also, I think her simulations address this problem. For the first time with HST, if we manage to service it, it'll have a really nice spectrograph called Cosmic Origin Spectrograph. And in the Cycle 17 round of proposals, myself and my team were awarded 134 orbits to actually address this problem systematically for the first time. What we're doing is that we got 43 pairs of quasars and galaxies selected from Sloan, where the quasars are bright enough to do with COS. And we distributed the galaxies in two parameter space, two axes, of impact parameter and stellar mass, according to the Sloan photometry. And the idea is that we want to take all of this absorption line data, such as Lyman series lines, carbon, various ionization species of the metals, and particularly oxygen 6, the signature of hot gas, and we want to make an aggregate map using these 43 objects to, for the first time, make a systematic map of multiphase gas and galaxy halos. All the galaxies are about redshift 0.2, and the stellar masses are about where you want to be to study things like the Milky Way and more massive. We have a nice natural distribution breakdown between blue galaxies according to Sloan's color criterion and red galaxies, so we're probing that transition. And actually, I spoke too soon. We do, in fact, have a little bit of data. Prochaska, who's one of my collaborators on this, has been to Keck recently and got a spectrum of one of our galaxies with a nice star-forming O2 line and an absorption signature of magnesium 2 in the halo of this galaxy. This is about 130 kiloparsec separation. If you add up all of the pairs like this that we got just by chance in every previous study, you get maybe 5, and we're going to get 43 systematically. So why am I saying this here now? The reason is, even though we may not get this data set in hand for more than a year from now, it's important now that anybody who has access to high-powered numerical simulations and is interested in this problem should start making me theoretical plots that look like this, so that once we get the data, we can go back toward the physics and ask what is actually giving rise to these multiphase ion signatures that we're seeing, with the hope that maybe we'll unravel galaxy accretion and feedback in some systematic way. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. Quick question? Okay, let's thank Jason again, and let's move to our final talk. So our final talk will be Michiko Fuji, who is looking at Trojan stars in the galactic center. So finally, the belly of the beast is being represented now.
Yep. I'm Michiko Fuji from the University of Tokyo. Well, we performed for the first time self-consistent in-body simulation of supermassive black hole, galaxy, and star cluster system using Blitz scheme. This Blitz scheme is a tree and direct hybrid scheme developed for this simulation. Now, once an NBH formed through the runaway collision in the star cluster, the mean motion resonance with the supermassive black hole and intermediate mass black hole carried stars to the galactic center. Well, this the bottom left figure shows the orbit of the IMBH and stars. They were bound to the cluster, but not now. The right panel shows the orbit of the stars in the rotational frame of the intermediate mass black hole. They were caught in the resonance. The IMBH sinks to the galactic center due to the dynamical friction. And these resonant stars also sink to the galactic center. It's a new channel to carry young stars to the galactic center. Thank you.
Thank you.
well, this model is about 10,000 solar masses. Yeah, but I tried other models, well, 5,000 to 1.3.
Yeah. Yeah. Michiko, how far can you transport stars? So how far can you bring them into the center from wherever they start? What's like sort of a maximum, for this process to work, what's the sort of maximum transport length for a typical size black hole in your simulations? You say it's a new channel to carry young stars to the galactic center, so how far away can you bring them?
Well, this model, the initial position of the star cluster is around 10 parsecs from the galactic center. And
okay, let's thank Michiko and all of the speakers today. And we will now schmooze for half an hour, and then the debate will be broadcast in the auditorium, which is across the courtyard and to the right, if you want to see that. And of course, dinner will be at 6:30. So thanks, everybody.